Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Do you like Sheffield Live? Why not become a friend of Sheffield Live? Sheffield Live is a community radio station, and friends of Sheffield Live are people in the community who make a regular donation to keep Sheffield Live on the air. Join the Friends of Sheffield Live by writing to friends@sheffieldlive.org or go online to sheffieldlive.org/friends. Do you want to get your message heard? With low advertising rates and great sponsorship opportunities, Sheffield Live can help you reach thousands of local people. Get your campaign on Sheffield Live. To find out more about advertising on Sheffield Live, write to advertising@sheffieldlive.org or call 0114 281 4082.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Lines with Sarah Evans-Olwyn. Between the Lines is a conversation which delves beyond the surface. It is long-form radio to be enjoyed at your leisure. Between the Lines brings you thoughtful people who will chat about their interests, their process, their philosophy, in and amongst other lovely snippets. It goes beyond review or gossip and into the warmth of listening deeply. You can listen to this show on Sheffield Live on Tuesday mornings at 11 a.m. on 93.2 FM or on the Simple Radio app. You can also catch me on Mixcloud at Revolve 77 if you want to catch up later. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Gemma Ballard, who will be talking about her work in the East Asian Studies Department at the University of Sheffield and her book on Korean cinema, which is called Urban Landscapes and National Visions in Postmillennial South Korean Cinema, From Seoul to Seoul. It's a lovely title. And this is a book that is hot off the press. It can be found online at Palgrave or at your university library or your online bookshop. I'm really delighted, Gemma, that we're here today and that we can chat not only about your work, but also hopefully about your other interests and possibly some recommendations if we have time for our listeners. But I was hoping, Gemma, that we could start off by talking a bit about perhaps your work at the university, what a typical day is like for you as an academic, and maybe some of the things that you enjoy about your work, and maybe the things you enjoy a bit less about your work, if you feel comfortable sharing those.
Yeah, of course. Thank you, Sarah, and thank you for that introduction. It's very kind. So yes, I work in the East Asian Studies Department in Sheffield, and I'm a lecturer in East Asian Studies. And in terms of my teaching, which is probably something that I enjoy most about the job, my teaching focuses a lot on media and cultural studies in East Asia. So I talk a lot about all the popular things that students seem to love these days, K-pop, cinema, Japanese cinema, anime. I teach on all those different kinds of things, which is always really enjoyable because I think what we find is that a lot of students join our department with specific interests in popular culture in East Asia, which is understandable because I feel like everybody knows a lot more about East Asia now because of all this thriving cultural activity now that's coming out of that region of the world. I mean, even my parents know who BTS are, for example, and they know very little about Korea, but they know who BTS are, which I think says an awful lot about how globalised South Korea is becoming, for example. So a lot of my teaching focuses on that and how these texts are received both domestically and internationally. Elsewhere within the department, I'm also director of recruitment, so my work very much focuses on increasing the visibility of our department and letting people know who we are and what we do and what the work is that, you know, the work that we do. I do a lot of school visits, which I really enjoy, and going to colleges and sixth forms and spreading the word about the School of East Asian Studies. Because I think what I've also found as well for school visits is that in terms of our UK curriculum, it's still quite an unexplored area, East Asia, but there is an interest there. And I think if we can plant the seed at that stage, it just persuades more people at that age to explore East Asia and perhaps find how their own interests align with East Asia in some way, whether it's if they have a, you know, if students have an interest in history, for example, or politics or international relations, I always feel that all roads in some way lead back to East Asia. So a lot of what the work I do does focus on that as well, and just promoting our department. But in terms of the day-to-day, no 2 days look the same, which I really enjoy. I enjoy the variety of different jobs that I have and roles and responsibilities. I think that's one of the great things about working in academia in terms of I'll have teaching and research, obviously, and all these different kinds of duties, which means that it never gets boring, which is what I really like. Doesn't mean that it's not stressful from time to time. There are always the odd days that I find sometimes a little bit stressful, but I actually find it a very rewarding job. And the best thing is you get to meet so many different kinds of people, students, academics, just other people working within the university as well across different departments. What I really like about the role is that there are lots of opportunities to collaborate, whether it's through research or teaching or in being involved in different events as well for the university. So I'm very happy at the moment in the job, and I'm very excited to see where I can go in the future as well within my role.
So that's really interesting to hear, Gemma, because of course higher education has had its fair share of ups and downs, particularly over the last few years. And we're coming out of a period of quite difficult relations between the university and its employees. Absolutely. And also, I suppose, some fraught times between students and the university post-COVID and through the strikes and so on. Do you find those issues encroach on your work sometimes?
Yes, I think in some ways they do, especially in the post-COVID era. I think, like you say, I think the landscape of further education is changing and constantly evolving. But what I found recently in conversations as well with students who are thinking about going to university but not entirely sure if that's the right path for them is there's a question about things like expense, obviously, and the financial viability moving forward of going to university, because it's a huge commitment. And I think what schools are exploring now is that, you know, there are other options for students. And I think that the narrative around university level education has changed, at least at school level. There are now various apprenticeships that students can get involved with. So for me, rather than going to these schools, for example, and try and persuade them or that university is the way they have to go, I try to instead tell them that there are a variety of options and a wealth of opportunities that await them, and it all depends on whether their interests and passions align with a specific field, even at that stage, because that's something that I feel only a university level of education can help you explore to a full degree. Really, if students have a very specific kind of interest at that stage when they're about to leave school, I think it's always worth looking into university just to think about what you can possibly lead on to after you have that degree. But I think in terms of how schools are engaging students in life after being a 16-year-old and moving on from that stage of life, there are a lot more options, I think. And that's all incredibly positive, but for me it's about trying to get students to think about what their own interests and passions are and seeing how we as a university can help to support those passions and interests and hopefully have them lead on to a really fruitful career in the future as well, which I think is something that universities have always provided, and especially so here in Sheffield, and even more so within our department as well. That's something that we really take seriously. I'm also I'm also the employability lead for the department. So that's part of my role, is helping students find out what their potential career paths could be, how they get there, who they need to speak to, and all those kinds of things, which is also a really rewarding part of the job. Because we want our students to go and be successful and thrive. And I think that's really important, even more so now post-COVID, because we've had such a turbulent few years, and with the news as well recently, the very kind of negative stories coming out of the news about the economy and the cost of living crisis, it's all placing, I suppose, a lot of pressure on young people at the moment. But we always like to think we're here to reassure them and to let them know that everything is a stepping stone to something bigger and better. And when they graduate with us, for example, their first job they get after graduation may not be their forever job, but it will lead on to something bigger and better, like I said. And we very rarely find that, I suppose, the career trajectory of our students is very rarely linear. It's more of a zigzag shape, which I think is normal for a lot of graduates. So it's about reassuring them that that's normal, and it's okay not to know exactly what you want to do, whether it's after school or after you graduate from university or even after having completed an apprenticeship or an internship. It's okay not to know or to be 100% sure where you're going in the future, just as long as you're, you know, proactive about those kinds of decision making. I think it means that there are really positive things in your future. That was certainly my philosophy going through college and university, and even, you know, after university getting my PhD. I think just being positive in that way and knowing that there are always options is the best way to move forward.
That's so interesting, Gemma. And it kind of leads me to my next question, which is a little bit more about your journey and your path. I was wondering, how did you get interested in South Korean cinema? What was your route? What were your interests? How did you get to this point here today?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, really, because it certainly wasn't what I intended on exploring when I was at school. And I had quite lofty ambitions when I was at school. I knew that I wanted to go to university, and I knew that I wanted to do a PhD.
So you knew that at school age?
Yeah.
That you wanted to do a doctorate?
Absolutely, yeah. I had a very clear plan of what I wanted to do, and a lot of that was due to one teacher that I had at the time, my English literature teacher, Mr. Tenniswood. I have to give him a shout out every time because he expects me to as well. But yeah, he challenged me in ways that really were crucial, I suppose, during those formative years. And he just had this level of belief in me that he instilled within me that I could go on and do a PhD even from that young age. He was my teacher from the age of 14. And I was very interested in English literature at the time anyway. I've always been a keen reader, and I absolutely loved English literature with him. He made me love the subject even more than I already did by that point. And at the same time, I also vividly remember that during his lessons, he would always find ways to integrate film within the classroom space as well. So that may have, again, planted the seed of film studies even at that stage. Even with things like when we were studying Shakespeare, he would always have on hand an adaptation, most likely a Kenneth Branagh adaptation of a Shakespeare play for us to watch as well. And he would ask us to think about how certain scenes were shot as well, compared to seeing things live in on the theatre, for example. So it was that kind of analytical thinking that he really embedded within me from a fairly early stage as well. And I knew from then on that I wanted to move into college, that I absolutely had to take English as an A-level, but also film studies. And luckily the college that I went to did film studies, and it was a fantastic film studies course as well. And my teacher, again at the time, a lot of I suppose, the journey that I've had and my position now, a lot of it is down to the teachers that I've had. So Julie Hamm was my A-level film studies teacher, and she was wonderful. She taught me the introduction to film studies, basically, which is what you would expect from an A-level course. But that was when we started to delve into other national cinemas, in addition to British and American film, for example. And then it wasn't until university when I did a joint honours in English and film studies as well at Derby University that I had my first dedicated module on East Asian cinema, and that really broadened my horizons. I absolutely loved that module. We looked at cinema from... we looked at the classics from Japan, China, South Korea, and it was a real crash course, I suppose, in East Asian cinema. It was incredibly helpful.
So what are some of the classics? Because you're talking about the classics, and it would be really nice for our listeners to get a flavour of the kind of exposure that you had at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we started with Japan. I vividly remember we started with the Japan and we looked at Kurosawa. One of the big texts that I suppose most film studies degrees look at is Rashomon, as well. Just because if you're wanting to learn about film narrative, Rashomon is definitely it's a kind of rite of passage for most film studies degree students. And then we ventured into more modern cinematic fare as well. We looked at we moved into the kind of that genre of extreme East Asian cinema as well. That was the first time I watched Battle Royale, for example, which was just huge fun at the time, discussing that film and thinking about linking it to wider social contexts, linking it to the wider political landscape of Japan at that time as well when it was released. And that's what I think I really enjoyed about film studies, is that, you know, you can read a film in the same way that you read a book. That's always been my philosophy. You can interpret it in the same way. You can look for symbolism. You can look for specific moments of dialogue or the way that things are shot. And you can apply them to these bigger critical contexts and frameworks, and national frameworks, I should say, that just help you to understand it on a much deeper level. That's not to say that I don't still enjoy going to the cinema and watching something completely at surface level and not thinking too much about it. I think there's huge value in having that kind of experience as well. And I can turn it off if I want. It's very easy to just turn it off and not have that analytical lens on things all the time. But I do think it gives you a much deeper appreciation of film when you learn all those basics about textual analysis and understanding narrative and genre and things like that. So we covered all that at university, but we applied those frameworks to specific East Asian films. That was the first time I watched Three Iron by Kim Ki-duk as well, which is my favourite Korean film. It probably always will be, because it was the first Korean film that I watched at that time, and it stayed with me ever since, and it's in my book as well.
And you teach a specific lecture on it, don't you, for film studies students in the first year at this university?
Absolutely. So the film studies is in a different department to mine. It's in the School of English, which is actually where I did my PhD as well. But yes, every so often I'll go back and do a guest lecture for their introduction to cinema module, and it's quite self-indulgent on my part, because I always end up bringing Three Iron into the picture when I'm talking about Korean cinema, just because I think it's part of that new wave of Korean filmmaking. Kim Ki-duk was part of that directorial canon that emerged in the late 80s and through the 90s to the early 2000s. So to me, at least, it is a pivotal Korean text. It is incredibly divisive, though. A lot of people absolutely hate it. A lot of people have significant... they have significant issues with Kim Ki-duk as a director as well. He actually passed away during COVID, through COVID-related complications, I believe. But yes, it is an incredible... Three Iron is a very divisive text, but I personally love it. I think it was because I just watched... It was the first Korean film that I watched, so for that reason it has stayed with me. And I feel like there's so much you can take away from it, and every time I watch it, even now, there's something new that I find in it that I didn't see before, which I feel like all great films do that. You can watch them time and time again and still see something new.
So that's really interesting, Gemma. So I suppose I should say to our listeners that we know each other from a few years ago when we met on the master's course at Sheffield University. And we met on a contemporary American module, didn't we? Which is a literature module. So you carried that literature element through along with your film element through until you did your PhD. So you've always been a reader. You've always been an analyst of writing as well as film.
Yeah, absolutely. That master's course was brilliant. I have such fond memories of that master's course as well. But I think it helps each discipline it helps film studies if you're a reader, and it helps literature studies if you watch films as well. They work hand in hand, and a lot of the critical theory that you use to understand both, they cross over on both disciplines. So it's always something that, and I actually really struggled at one point to commit to the film studies side of things, just because I was so, from that school age, I always assumed that if I was going to do a PhD, it would be in English literature. I always had a very keen interest in 19th century English literature, but again, that started at secondary school when Mr. Tenniswood made me read Bronte and Jane Austen, and as young as kind of 13 I was reading those books and I absolutely fell in love with them, and I always assumed that would be my kind of educational career trajectory would be aligned alongside those kinds of texts. So it's looking back in hindsight, it's a wonderful thing, but it always surprises me that I actually went down a very different path. But the skills and the sort of the analytical lenses that I used when I was studying literature, I still use them for film studies. And I probably wouldn't be where I am now if I hadn't have taken those literature modules, if I hadn't have done the master's, for example, with you and done the American literature module. It all collectively has helped me get to where I am now, and I'll never completely abandon that side of myself either. It's hugely important to how I understand all of these different texts.
So it's interesting, I'm thinking about the way that some students might view East Asian studies and believe that they need to have an interest in language in order to do it, but actually you've come at it from the literature side of things and the film side as a road into East Asian studies.
Absolutely. It's all about critical studies to me. Obviously the language component is hugely important, and a lot of the students who join us, they join because they want to learn Korean, they want to learn Japanese, they want to learn Mandarin. But for me, when I, for example, when I'm delivering our presentation on open days, for example, just for any listeners, if you do join us on open days, it's more than likely that I will be there. So do come and say hello. But yes, to me, I think, as I said, all roads can lead to East Asia. If you're interested in literature, if you're interested in history, geography, media and culture, it's such a vibrant region of the world, and I think all of the skills that you acquire throughout school and throughout college, they can be applied to the East Asian context. That's certainly what happened for me. So I you know, it can happen for anyone else that's possibly wanting to learn more about East Asia, but they think, well, how can I transfer the skills or the interest that I have in English literature, for example, to the East Asian context? But I prove that can happen, because that's essentially what happened for me.
So that's so interesting, and I think it's an example of how you can find a route in, even if you thought it might not be for you, or
Absolutely.
You were, you know, you've just got an interest.
Yeah.
So I think this leads us quite nicely to talk about your book, which has a really lovely name as well. Yeah. So like some academic titles of articles and books struggle to distill really what they're about, but I feel that your book really does distill
it.
I just wondered if you wanted to talk to us about writing the book, what the PhD journey was like, whether you have like a routine for your writing, a routine for your thinking and reading, and whether you've got a philosophy, you know, that you can share with our listeners, because, you know, you could help someone, I suppose, people that struggle, you know, to get their thoughts into, you know, some kind of usable context.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm no authority, I suppose, on this subject, because I appreciate that everyone has their own different methods when it comes to writing. But, and I also forgot to mention as well that one thing that I did learn was from you, Sarah, because you, one day we were talking about this, I think it was while we were both in our Treasure Haven DVD library in School of English, but you always said, never throw away the scraps, keep them in a document. And I hadn't been doing that up until that point. Any kind of scraps that I thought, well, they're not going to be useful, I would just delete them straight away. But you actually told me, no, just put them all into a document. And it was probably one of the best pieces of advice on writing that I've ever received. I don't delete anything now. Everything goes into a document somewhere to be saved for another day. And it's actually been really helpful, because you find kind of nuggets of, in the scraps, you find nuggets of potential within those scraps that I've actually ended up elaborating on and creating an entirely new chapter from just that nugget within that scrap. And I'm so glad that you told me, because before that point, I used to just press delete and never think of it again. But now nothing gets deleted. And I think that's one piece of advice that came from you that I absolutely live by now.
Wow, I'm really shocked.
Yeah, it was definitely, I remember you telling me, and it stayed with me ever since. And I use it all the time now. Nothing gets deleted. But in terms of, I suppose, my wider philosophy on writing, would it be really too simplistic to say you've just got to write? Just write. I know that sounds really ridiculous, but if it's just about getting it down on the paper, don't worry about how it sounds initially. You can sort out all the finer details later. I think even if it just sounds like a stream of consciousness on the page, it's all valid and it's all useful. And that's certainly what I did throughout my PhD, particularly when I was going through stages where I was really struggling, which I think is normal with the PhD. You go through ebbs and flows through the writing process, where I went through stages where I had really bad writer's block, but anything that came to my mind, I would get it down. And it did end up in the finished product. Even if at the time I read it and think this is absolute drivel, it doesn't make any sense, it's not useful to me at all. But I think even just the motion of typing and writing it and seeing it on a screen in front of you, or even writing things down on a pad and paper, I think as long as you keep within that frame of mind, it's practicing every day, it's practicing the craft every day. So to me, it's not any kind of secret philosophy or anything like that. I think you just have to sit down and write, and don't kind of worry about the details until later on.
Do you write at a certain time of day?
I tend to write best in the morning. I do tend to go through a bit of a slump once the afternoon hits. I don't know if that's just because after lunch I tend to feel tired after I've eaten and things like that, but I tend to get most of my, I'm most productive in the mornings, which I think a lot of people are. I'm not a night owl. I'm an early bird. I like to get up early, start the day, and if I can get some writing done, I'll do it in the morning. But again, I think it's about not putting pressure on yourself as well. If I tell myself I have to write, I struggle to do it. If I put pressure on myself in that way and say it's something I have to do, it's a very laborious process. Whereas if I'm struggling, I'll step away from it for a few days, and then naturally it will come back to me and I'll feel the urge to sit down and write again. And that's when for the book and for my PhD, I feel like that was when I produced some of my best writing when I wasn't putting that kind of pressure on myself. But then again, for me, it was very different doing my PhD because it was through COVID. So I didn't have much else to do, to be honest with you. I was at home every day, and all I had to do was focus on the PhD. So I had very few other distractions, which I absolutely worked in my favour for the latter stages of the PhD, obviously. So I think working from home in that way, it really helped me as well. I was in a very comfortable environment. We had great weather in that. I don't know if you can remember, but
yeah,
the weather
was lovely.
The weather was wonderful in those first few months of COVID. So I could work out in the garden if I wanted to. I was very fortunate to have an outdoor space at that time. So, just looking back, even though COVID was, for many obvious reasons, an absolutely terrible time for many people, in terms of giving me the space and the time and the environment to write, it worked very well in my favour for completing the PhD, essentially. And I did my final examination online, which I really very much enjoyed as well. It was very much more of a supportive and nurturing conversation, not quite as stressful as I imagine it would have been had I been facing a panel of people in person, which is why I have the utmost respect for postdocs who went through that process of doing the face-to-face viva, because that's something that I didn't have to do at the time.
So interestingly, you found that the online remote environment in the viva was more nurturing and positive than being in the room with the people that were going to quiz you on your work.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if it's because by that point we'd all become conditioned ourselves to online meetings. So it was something that I was very much used to by that point. So in that way, it was the familiarity that made it much more stress-free. And I have to say I was very fortunate with my examiners. They were both incredibly supportive, and they were just very interested in what I had to say. They were interested in my thesis. They wanted to know, similar to things that you've asked me today, they wanted to know more about my route into this particular piece of research and why I found it interesting, which I think fostered a much more natural discussion at the time. But who knows? I mean, if I'd have had to do it in person, I honestly couldn't say what would have happened, because that would have been very unfamiliar to me at the time. And I think some people thrive on that kind of situation, but for me, if I'm facing a panel of people across a desk and I'm having to explain my work to them in an almost interview-like situation, that's something I really struggle with, and I still struggle with similar things like that even to this day. It's not something that comes naturally to me at all, but I suppose with that, practice makes perfect. But at least for my viva, the stars seem to align, and it was actually a very enjoyable process. And I've been asked on a few occasions to give advice to postgraduate researchers within our faculty and just talk about my own experiences, and to me it really is an opportunity to show off and to be proud of the work that you've produced. And I always say to anybody who's about to face that situation that you are the expert in that area, and don't let any examiner make you feel otherwise. You're the person that has dedicated years of your life to this one piece of research. You know it best. They don't. As much, you know, even if you have a particularly, a challenging supervisor, or you receive challenging questions, just know that you are the authority on that subject. Just show off and enjoy it in that way. If you can show off and be proud of the work you've produced, that to me is the best way to get through that viva.
So, I mean, I think that's really lovely advice, and it's sort of affirming advice as well. Tell me a little bit, or tell our listeners a little bit about this idea of post-millennial South Korean cinema. What were you trying to say in your work? And was the process of turning your PhD thesis into a book, what was that like for you? Was it weird?
Yes, it was weird. And because, again, it was so new to me, it's the first time I've published a book. So in terms of, I struggled with the logistical publishing side of things a little bit, just meeting specific guidelines set out by the publisher, all those kind of nitty-gritty formulaic things that you have to follow. They can sometimes be a bit overwhelming, but I was supported well by my editor at the time, and she, if I had any questions, I could just email her. So it wasn't too much of a strenuous process at all. And in terms of actually adapting the PhD to the book, that was actually a really nice experience, because the book is very much a almost page for page adaptation of my PhD. It's just I added some extra bits in there, which was nice because I had the finished manuscript there already, and it was just about refining it, perfecting it, adding bits in, and because I had to take into account as well the time that had passed between receiving my PhD and publishing the book and the deadline that I had for the book. Obviously, academia is, the field is developing all the time, the research field is developing all the time, so I had to take that into account and add certain things in certain sections. But actually, it was a fairly straightforward process just because I had the manuscript there ready in the form of my PhD.
I love that you write in the introduction about Parasite and you acknowledge that this film is just taken the world by storm, but what you say is, and I think it's so interesting because it chimes with my experience of reading some East Asian books, you know, that we think, oh, this is brand new, it's new and shiny, and you talk about the decades of foregrounding before you reach the Parasite stage.
Absolutely.
And that world recognition, and I think that about books that have been translated from a Korean or from Japanese that are sort of finding traction now, but they were written 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really glad you picked up on that, actually, because I really wanted Parasite to kind of provide a bookmark to the beginning and the end of the book. So I talk about Parasite in the introduction, and then I bring it around in a kind of full circular moment and talk about it in the conclusion as well. And like you say, I think when it won the Oscar especially, and it occupied this very significant space in global film culture, in the global film cultural sphere, I suppose, in quite a profound way. And that was just cemented when it won the Oscar. But like you said, it isn't anything new, particularly if you've looked at Bong Joon-ho's previous films. And I really feel like Parasite is an amalgamation of all the elements that we see in his previous films. And then even sort of journeying back even further than that, Bong's directorial style is an amalgamation of the different trends that Korean cinema has explored as an industry, even from its infant stages. And he has very deliberate allusions to other classical Korean directors as well that emerged, particularly those that emerged in the 1960s after post-liberation, post-division. So his films do contain very deliberate allusions, like I said, to all of these other Korean, very important Korean films as well. So I think that's why it's very important to consider Korean cinema take a more trans-historical, inter-historical approach to Korean cinema. Thinking of it more as on a much broader filmic timeline, rather than, as is the case very often, thinking about it in terms of these peaks and troughs that the industry has experienced throughout the 20th and 21st centuries, which of course it has. And I think a lot of these questions that I had and thoughts that I had did inform both my PhD and the book, because what we're seeing increasingly, in my mind, in academia, is that because South Korea is becoming so globalised now, and because it's so not just Korean cinema, but Korean culture more broadly is becoming so popular. It's being read very frequently in terms of its relationship to either other East Asian industries, so China, Japan, that kind of transnational approach, or it's being compared frequently to the West and America. And I can see that there's always going to be academic merit in taking those kinds of approaches, because due to its history, Korean cinema and other forms of Korean popular culture, they have been, of course, been influenced by particularly Japan and America. So it kind of made me think, okay, well, is it okay to just approach Korean cinema in this way? And I suppose a more pivotal question for me is, what is actually Korean about Korean cinema? And do we have to actually think of this in terms of, well, what is Korean identity and how is that portrayed in Korean cinema as well? All of these questions were kind of running through my mind in the early stages of my PhD thesis. And one of the common factors, the more Korean films that I watched for my research and the more readings that I looked at, one of the common factors that emerged was how a lot of Korean films have this very distinctive engagement with the urban landscape. And I thought, okay, there's an idea here. Looking at how Seoul specifically is represented in Korean film and how actually it can be used as a way to nationalise Korean cinema, as something that sets it fundamentally apart from other East Asian cinemas and from America and the West and the American film industry. So that was really the starting point for the book. And I think Seoul is a hugely important city. I think it's changed and evolved and transformed alongside Korean society. Its very infrastructure has changed alongside those very turbulent historical events that, you know, we're very familiar with. Korea's 20th century history is incredibly turbulent, and I think it's amazing how Seoul, even in terms of the physical landscape, it reflects those turbulences, if you like. I think for me, Seoul is a great landscape to explore within Korean cinema because it's very hybrid, and Korean cinema is often characterised for its hybridity as well. So I think it lends itself well to, it informs that hybridity in many ways. And I think just from a kind of textual stance, because Seoul is so hybrid, it often shapes how we perceive things like genre in Korean cinema as well. The city transforms depending on the genre that is being explored for a particular Korean film. It helps to shape narrative and character and all those different kinds of things. So the book really is comprised of five different case studies, and each case study looks at the city in a very specific way. So I have the psychogeographical city, which is where I look at Three Iron, the hypermasculine city, which is where I look at Korean gangster films, and particularly The Man from Nowhere, which is an amazing film, I highly recommend it. We have the suppressive city, which looks at female experience on screen as well, Korean women's narratives, which are grossly overlooked still within the Korean film industry at this moment. And I also look at the oppositional city, which looks at kind of transnational exercises, looks at the film Okja, which is on Netflix at the moment, another Bong Joon-ho film. So the book is really comprised of five very distinct case studies, which is what I liked because I wanted readers to be able to enter it at any point, really. You don't have to necessarily read it from beginning to end. It would be great if you do that, but I think in terms of just for academic study purposes, for students, for example, I wanted them to be able to take these standalone chapters and use them in whatever way they needed to for their own studies, which was really important to me as well. So that's I realise I've not very eloquently summarise what the book is about there, but that's kind of what the book is looking at.
So I think it's really interesting how you outline the way that you structured the book, mm. and that you had an intended audience yeah. in there. Yeah. So that your PhD thesis was almost designed to be transformed into book form, and it's almost like a textbook which you can, as you say, you use that nice word about bookmarking, it's almost like you're saying this was written, you know, in the 2020s, this is when this research has taken place. You're giving it a timestamp in a way.
Absolutely. I think it's strange that you say about mentioning about writing for a specific audience in mind, because when I was writing the PhD, on which the book is based, obviously, I don't think I had a specific audience in mind, but as I was progressing throughout the first year, I'd say, of that PhD, it became increasingly evident to me that this was designed for a particular audience. And something that I've always been interested in throughout the PhD process and throughout this creating the book as well, is how Korean cinema is taught in further education as well. This is hopefully going to be inform my next piece of research, because it's something I've been interested in for a few years now, about how not East Asian cinema but Korean cinema specifically, how it's taught at university level, because I think obviously most film studies courses at degree level, they do look at East Asian cinema and they will look at Korean cinema as well, because I think, like I've outlined in the book, there are, in academia at least, what I've noticed is that there is a trend to criticise national cinematic approaches now, or national cinema as a theoretical framework. Mm-hmm. A lot of academics see it as quite antiquated in some ways. It promotes difference and exclusivity. I've never really thought of national cinema as being that way at all. And I actually think it's crucial that we are still able to identify characteristics that allow us to say, this is a Korean film, this is a Japanese film, this is a British film, this is a German film. And I think if we lose that and we go down the kind of transnational route even more so than we already are, I think we risk losing the autonomy of these industries, of these global industries, that, you know, it's really important to informing our understanding of film studies more widely anyway. So I'm always curious to know how lecturers, my peers, are teaching this subject at university level as well. That's something that I hope to be able to explore further in the
future.
That's
so interesting.
Just to gain some insights there and think about how we might, again, just consider more options, I think, is what's needed.
And it's so interesting because, like, as you say that, I'm thinking about how all art is created in some kind of context, isn't it? Like, you cannot sort of do a standalone approach where you say that this just appeared from nowhere, because it doesn't. It always comes from something. It comes
Absolutely.
From somewhere, and it comes from a location.
Nothing's original. Yeah. nothing's entirely original. And it's not to say that I don't think we should, you know, compare Korean cinema to and take note of those influences, some of which are very apparent from American filmmakers and from Japan because of the colonial period. Those colonial influences on cultural production, they're still very much evident in Korean culture now. But I think that's almost a reason why as well we have to fight harder to note it for Korean cinema and Korean popular culture more widely. That's why we have to fight even harder to recognise it as this independent force, because obviously throughout the 20th century it was in many ways, because of these external factors and forces, it was denied the right to form its own cultural autonomy for sustained periods throughout the 20th century. So to me now it's even more important that we recognise Korean cinema in particular as this very independent, self-aware in many ways, but independent and autonomous institution.
That's really interesting. So Gemma, you've recently returned from South Korea, And I'm just so interested to know what you did, how you found it, what the weather was like, and, you know, what your thoughts are on your trip, because it was a research trip and you were taking students as well, I believe.
Yes, so I absolutely cannot take the credit for this. That all goes to Dr. Sarah Son, who is the head of the Korean Studies programme in our department. She's absolutely brilliant. And a lot of her research focuses on North-South inter-Korean relations. And basically, we received some external funding from an organisation in Korea called the Uni-Korea Foundation, which focuses on issues pertaining to the North-South divide. And we received some funding from them to take basically a very small group of students from our department over to Korea for 12 days. We had a very hectic schedule, most of which was organised by Sarah. And as part of the trip, we were basically asked by the Uni-Korea Foundation to think about the division, think about the North-South divide at the moment, think about issues around reunification, because, you know, these are very big questions. And it was interesting to see how throughout the process of the trip, our students, their opinions altered depending on who we were visiting on particular days, which was really interesting to see. I was there as a kind of support staff member to observe and take notes. And I think further down the line, Sarah and I are hoping to produce an article from this as well, in which we talk about how students engaged with these topics and with these organisations as well. So while we were out there, we visited various non-government organisations, as well as the Ministry of Reunification, to learn more about what the government is doing to help raise awareness around the North-South divide and what policies they have in terms of actually pursuing reunification. What's interesting is, though, is it became very quickly apparent was that there was a huge disconnect between what the government was doing and what these non-government organisations were doing. Because it's such a heavily politicised issue in South Korea at the moment, a lot of what the non-government organisations were doing was focusing on human rights issues in North Korea and very much trying to take the politics out of it and focus on individual case studies, individual stories, and helping and using those stories to make South Koreans aware of what is happening in North Korea. It was a very different story when we looked at when we went to visit the Ministry of Reunification, which had a very their policies seemed to be quite almost superficial and shallow in nature, using a particular rhetoric that outwardly tried to suggest that they were pursuing reunification, but it became clear that actually it doesn't seem to be very high on their agenda. And a lot of this has been magnified by the current president, who Yoon Suk-yeol, who now has taken a hardline stance against North Korea, very different to, for example, Moon Jae-in, who a lot of his policies revolved around reunification and pursuing reunification. Yoon Suk-yeol has taken a very different approach. He's once again enforced that kind of hardline stance against North Korea, looking at the military and nuclear deterrence and all those kinds of things. It's very much different, a very vastly different administration to what Moon Jae-in did a few years ago, for example. And I think the students became very aware of that throughout the trip. So it was an eye-opening experience, a once-in-a-lifetime experience for me as well. But it was a huge pleasure to see how students interacted with these various organisations. But also, just from my perspective, it was great to see how students were able to feel more confident about working out there as well, because some of the organisations we went to, one of which had a graduate from SEAS, from the School of East Asian Studies, was working there, and she'd had a very, really interesting career path as well. So I think for the students that was incredibly helpful, for those that want to work out there, because it made them think, again, made them realise that there are a wealth of opportunities out there. It's just about being proactive and networking and introducing yourself and being confident to introduce yourself to all these different kinds of people, which the students did. We even visited the British Embassy, which was bizarre because you walked through these gates and it felt like we didn't feel like we were in Seoul anymore. It all of a sudden
an enclave.
It was. Yeah. We walked into these, you know, green grass garden with English roses. It was so surreal. And we even visited, there's a pub inside the embassy. So yeah, that was very bizarre. it was one of the best experiences I've ever had. And I'll never forget it. And it's all thanks to Dr. Sarah Son. She's just brilliant, and she organised the whole thing as well. So yeah, shout out to Dr. Sarah Son.
That's amazing, Gemma. It sounds so fascinating. I can't believe we're at the end of our show.
Oh no, I've talked for far too long.
No, it's been fantastic to hear about your journey, about your book, about the School of Southeast Asian Studies, not Southeast Asian, you're East Asian, you're not Southeast Asian, the School of East Asian Studies at the University of Sheffield, and to hear about the work that you've been doing. But I know I'm going to have to get you on again because there were so many other questions that I wanted to ask you.
I'd love to come on again.
So thank you, Dr. Gemma Ballard, for being my first ever guest on Between the Lines. You've been listening to Sarah Evans-Olwyn on Between the Lines. You can listen to the show again. You can listen to the show every week, Sheffield Live, on Tuesday mornings at 11 a.m. on 93.2 FM, or you can listen via the Simple Radio app. You can also catch me on Mixcloud at Revolve 77 if you want to listen later. And I will be here with you again at the same time next week.
Is never ending. Working night and day on the iron way, we're the boys who keep the engines rolling. You sign on at the loco shed, they put you to the cleaning. In your dungarees, cleaning super D's, you're a sweeper up, a brewer up, a shovel slinger, spanner, bring a steam, raise a fire, drop a general cook and bottle wash, you're learning how to keep on rolling. When you've done your time at the loco shed and had your share of trouble, on the old footplate, you're the driver's mate and you're married to a lousy shovel. It's check the water, check the tools and chuck the blooming coal in. Give the gauge a wipe, check, inject a pipe, now it's swing your shovel at the double, give a rock, watch the clock, steam raising sweat, running back, aching bone, shaking fireman, fireman, keep a rolling. When you've shoveled a million tons of coal some 10 or 12 years later, and your only dream is of raising steam, then they hand to you your driver's papers. The iron road is a hard road and the work is never ending. Working night and day, away. We're the local drivers, early risers, luncheon turners, mile burners, 11 quid a week earners. We're the boys who keep 'em rolling.